Okay, we are just coming up on 7:30, so I'm going to go ahead and mute all. As usual, you'll have the ability to unmute yourself. Please feel free to do so if you have a comment or question. Remute yourself afterwards. Keep background noise to a minimum. Later on this evening, the contents of the chat, the audio track, as well as PDF of the deck as we go through tonight will get posted on the website courtesy of Alan. And we have a fair number of items, a couple of longish ones there tonight that are in the queue. So we'll go ahead and get started, but just a reminder that if you have anything that you want to add, either as a question or a mini share or anything like that at all, feel free to throw it into the chat or unmute yourself after the main deck has gone through, and we'll cover off as many items as we can. And with that, I'll turn it over to Alan to lead us through tonight's deck.
Okay, thanks, Chris. I have a couple of short items to start with. First of all, I think this came from Karen. Just a note on a local scam. Somebody is sending out text messages saying that you have a speeding ticket from a speed camera and give you a link to pay the fine. However, the city doesn't collect money that way. They will only send it you by mail. So if you have a text message with a speed ticket, it's spam, and you should ignore it, or at least here it says you should report it to the Ottawa Police Service immediately. So I don't know what they're going to do about it, but you could report it to them. Anyway, don't pay unless it's a valid ticket coming through the mail. Then you might want to think about it. And then Chris found something very similar. This is Hydro Ottawa, or at least purporting to be from Hydro Ottawa. Texts and emails, again, demanding payment and offering you a refund. However, again, this is a scam. So you can always check with Hydro Ottawa themselves if your bill which you're receiving by email or by text is actually legitimate. So a couple of scams to watch out for, local ones. And be aware of the usual scams that are all over the place, unfortunately. So be aware. Okay, next up, Chris has a question to answer.
Yeah, so this came from Glenn through the suggestion box at opcug.ca mailbox. And so he was using Sophos Intercept X on his Android phone, and he enabled web filtering, and he got notified when he did that that permissions had to be granted to view and control screen as well as read all content on the screen. Next. And he was a little bit reluctant to give permission to read the screen, and he said especially when he signed into any accounts that there's sensitive information such as his banking account. Next. So his question was, how much protection is lost if you don't give Sophos Accessibility Service full control over the phone, which was the actual permission that was being requested. So next. So I figured, okay, well, let's see. I use Sophos Intercept X on my Android phone, and I had never gone through this, so I brought it up, and sure enough, web filtering is there, and it is off by default. And so if you tap it, then you get a place where you can actually turn on web filtering. And so you just tap that to enable it. And that's when you start getting the messages about, that you're going to have to give extra permissions to it. And, you know, if you look at what the thing says, I understand Sophos Intercept X for mobile uses Android Accessibility Service API, the application programming interface, to check links I open in supported web browsers. Now, it sort of makes sense that it's going to have to be able to read the page in order to do web filtering. So it says the link addresses are checked by Sophos Labs for undesirable content or known bad sites, I guess, and then they can actually block the content. So next. So if you check that box, and then it'll take you to that accessibility screen, and there is an option there for Sophos Accessibility Service, so you tap it. and then you will get an option to turn it on. So you tap to enable it, and you get that message at the bottom again saying why they want that permission. And then once it's enabled, it'll tell you that Sophos Accessibility Service has full control over your device. And what does that really mean? It says there it can view and control the screen, so read all content on the screen, display content over other apps. That sort of makes sense. And it can view or perform actions, so it can track your interactions with an app or a hardware sensor and interact with apps on your behalf. So that presumably is the idea of whether it's going to block something or allow the content to be displayed. So is that reasonable? So next. So is full control actually reasonable to request? So Sophos says it needs that permission in order to do the web filtering, and it sort of does make sense. So the question is, do you trust Sophos Intercept X to not do bad things? So if you do trust them, I would say, and you want web filtering to be on there to protect you, then yes. If you don't trust Sophos Intercept X, you think that they could do some bad things, then your only choice at that point is don't enable web filtering. And if you don't trust them, I would suggest that you probably want to uninstall Sophos Intercept X. Next. And really this comes down to where I think that this particular item for Q&A, it goes beyond Sophos Intercept X, because there are lots of other things that you're going to be installing on your phone and your PC and so forth, and you have to decide the risk. Cost-benefit analysis may be different for you than somebody else. So security is always a cost-benefit analysis. As security is increased, typically you're getting a benefit in return for that. So you have to decide if the benefit that you're going to get from it, in this case, it's protection from malicious websites, outweighs the cost, which would be the potential that Sophos will misuse data. Next. So again, looking at Sophos Intercept X in particular, but this applies to other things. This is something you should be going through every time you decide to install something on your PC. So first thing I do is I do a little bit of research on the web, see if Sophos is, a trustworthy organization. Is it trusted by other people? Has anybody flagged their software as being malicious? And does it have products that are worthwhile? You can trust the site, but if a product is useless, why bother installing it and having a potential vulnerability of some sort on there? Next. Then I'll look at reviews. Now, it's not proof of thing being safe, but if I look at this, there's 4.0 stars out of 5 in 46,500 reviews. Well, that's not bad. I might look at the one-star reviews and things like that and say, is it just a functionality issue that people are complaining about, or they don't think it does anything useful, or things like that, which I may assess it differently, or are they actually complaining about the fact that, Sophos is doing bad things? And there are over 1 million downloads. So, again, that's not bad. So, that's the sort of thing I look at. Next. The other thing I will look at is how recently updated is this app. And ideally, you want to know how long the app has been around. I will not install an app on my PC or my phone if it came out last month. I want it to give the test of time. I want other people to be the guinea pigs before that I offer up my hardware or my data as potential fodder for some nefarious character. So in this case here, it was recently updated. So it was updated on March 15th. And actively maintained apps is a good thing. It means they are around, they are fixing problems, they are enhancing, so forth. Next. So really what it comes down to is only you can decide whether you can trust an app or not. So it's not a bad idea that it was brought to Q&A and saying, hey, anybody else in the user group, do you have any issues with this, or what do you think should be done? That's great. That is one of several things that I think most people should do if they're looking at a new app. So, but again, I highly encourage people to do their own bit of research and their own assessment to decide whether it's good or bad for them. That's it for Sophos Intercept X.
Okay, thanks, Chris. A couple of comments from Tom. Firstly, he says he never does any banking on his phone. And secondly, he says on his phone he uses Quad9 DNS to avoid bad sites.
Yeah, Quad9 is great. I use it on my router at home, actually. So it everything that is connected through my router is automatically picking up that benefit. And Quad9, it was started by IBM Security, and it's now a consortium of about a dozen different security firms. And they have terabytes and terabytes of threat intelligence data on websites. And so they can very easily block you from any of those known bad sites. Stu, it's interesting that on the iPhone, InterceptX doesn't have the web filtering feature. I wonder if that's an Apple restriction that has been put on that doesn't allow vendors to do that, or seems odd that it would only be on available on Android. But good information. Thanks.
Apple phones never get hacked.
Okay, thanks, Chris. So moving along, a couple of YouTube tech videos that I thought were kind of interesting. Anybody has an old smartphone lying around? Here are five things which this guy thinks you can use your old phone for. And they're mostly video camera type things. A security camera, a webcam, and a dash cam. He also has a tip on how to use it as a wireless, either trackpad or mouse. And an interesting one, I thought, was to use the phone as a secondary display. So there are links in the video to tell you how to do that and what software you need to use for that. So in some situations, having an additional display and using a smartphone to get a small screen, clearly, but an extra display screen might be useful in some situations. And the next thing was what you can do if you have an old laptop, and especially if various parts are broken and other parts may not be. And so this video is kind of like a teardown of the equipment. And so one of the really interesting ones, I think, is this polar bear light on the right-hand side. That's actually breaking down this damaged screen into its component layers and using one of the layers on a couple of LEDs to create this kind of neat table lamp, essentially, or a feature light, because it doesn't really give you much illumination, but it's kind of a neat trick. And he also shows you how to use drives and all kinds of other stuff. He also shows you how to take the laptop battery apart and break out the individual cells with warnings not to short them out. And one of his suggestions is to make power banks out of them. And apparently you can buy these little external power bank cases, and you just drop the laptop battery in, or the individual cells are essentially AA cells. So you drop the cell into this little case, and you have a portable USB charger.
Correction, they're not AA cells; they're 1/8650s.
They look like AA cells. They're about that big anyway.
And there are a lot of flashlights that use them, and there are other uses for them as well. But a power bank is very handy.
If you're not really, really, really sure what you're doing, I say avoid it. Lithium-ion batteries have been known to explode, catch fire, and things like that, and they can be hard to put out.
Yeah, I think the video has warnings to that effect,
yeah.
If I remember rightly.
I think so, yeah.
Okay, thanks. Thanks for those comments. And the next item is Chris's part 3 of his sharing files series.
Yeah, thanks, Alan. So just a recap, a good article that I came across from Windows Intelligence, talking about different ways of sharing files. And there were four options that were actually shared. And I expanded that to one extra one. So on April 17th, I covered using wireless nearby sharing to be able to share either over Bluetooth or over Wi-Fi, as well as using cloud storage to do sharing, which each of them has their own charm and capabilities and problems as well. And then on May 1st, I covered network-attached storage, which is a way of having on your local network a device that its sole purpose is to serve up storage for anybody who is connected to the network. And then I added this extra one, which was not covered by Windows Intelligence. They were doing things more in line with built into infrastructure already there. And this is LocalSend, which is a third-party app, which I thought had some very interesting capabilities on it. And so I did up a few slides on it. And so this week, we're going to wrap up the series with traditional Windows network file sharing. Now, before I get into how to set it up, it's a little bit involved in getting it set up. It's not hard. But there are a number of steps that you have to go through. But I think overall, it is probably in the long run the most capable and easiest to deal with way of sharing files. So we'll go through that. So next. So the first thing you have to do is on every computer on the network that you want to be able to share files, either sending or receiving, you have to set the network profile to be private on each of those computers. And then you have to turn on network discovery and file sharing, which is an option that is in Windows. And then you have to actually share out folders. And then optionally, you can actually map drive letters to shares in order to make them easier to use long term. And we'll go through each of these steps. So next. So to set the network profile to private, you go to Settings, Network and Internet, and then next. You have to go to whatever your active network is. Now, the PC that I was on this one, it had both a Wi-Fi connection as well as an Ethernet or a plug-in connection. So whichever one is your active, you're probably only going to see one on most computers. But if you see two, just whatever is the active one that you're using, either a Wi-Fi connection or a plug-in Ethernet connection, select it. And next. Now, if you choose Wi-Fi, it'll bring up the list of Wi-Fi networks, and it'll show you the Wi-Fi network that you're currently attached to. And in my case, my network is called Andromeda. If you're going on and, okay, so go next. And then you'll see here, this one here was when I went on to an Ethernet connection, and it'll just automatically bring you to the spot where you have to choose it. If you're on an Ethernet connection, you don't have to choose what connection to do. So Wi-Fi, if you chose your Wi-Fi network, it'll then bring you to that option screen where you can say whether you want a public network, which is what it'll be by default. And it's what Microsoft says is recommended, but you have to change that to private network if you want to be able to share files. Next. And next. So once you've done that, and again, you're doing this on every computer on the network that you want to be able to do Windows file sharing on. So the next thing you do is you go to File Explorer, and in the left-hand panel, you select Network. Next. And then if you see at the top, Network Discovery and File Sharing are turned off, you click it to turn it on. Next. You'll get that pop-up menu, and you get that turn on. You get the bit of the shield there because that's something that requires administrative access to actually enable sharing. Next. So at this point, your file sharing is actually ready to go on all the computers, but you're not actually sharing anything. So it's just enabled the capability of sharing files, but now we actually have to do the sharing. Next. So going back to File Explorer, you can right-click on any, right-click on any folder. You cannot share a file. You have to share it by folder, or you can do an entire drive But what we're going to do is we're going to share a particular folder. In this case, I have a folder called Shared Files that I just set up that way. So right-click on that, and you'll get a context menu, and you can say Give Access To, and then you choose Specific People. Next. Now, the specific people that you actually want to select is absolutely everyone. So if you click that down-pointing chevron, then you can choose everyone. Now, you can choose a particular account, but I can guarantee you that until you're really used to how things work with Windows file sharing, it is far, far easier to just set it up so that everybody on the network is able to access these files with whatever permissions you give it. So choose the everyone, next. And then it'll come back to that dialog box, and you can choose everyone from the list of names, and then next. You set the permission level as you want it, and you could start off with, if you're a bit nervous on it, you could say read only, and that way other people on the network will be able to read the files in this particular folder, but they will not be able to edit them in place or add additional files to that. So eventually you probably want to change permission levels so that it is read-write, but you could choose right now. But if you're a little bit nervous about it, start off with a permission of read. Click next, and then you click the share button. Next. It'll come up with a summary, and it'll say your folder is shared, and it tells you that, you know, it's shared out as a particular share name, which is shared files, and the computer name, Aquila. And then you click on Done, and then you're now sharing things on the network. So now you go to one of the other computers on the network that you've set up the file sharing on already, and then you go to File Explorer, you select Network, and then you will actually see the computers that are on the network that are set up with file sharing. Now, I was on Aquila when I set up the file share, and so I'm on this other computer called Kuma, and so what I would do is click on Aquila, because that's where the shared file is, double-click on that, and then it will open up the list of shares on that computer. So you notice I don't see drive C, D, the C colon backslash Windows, anything like that. I only see those folders that I set up file sharing for, which at this point I only shared out this one folder called shared files, and the share name is actually just duplicates that by default. So the share name is actually called shared files. So you can access it through that. And if you double click on it, you can just go into that folder and you'll be able to have whatever permissions you gave from the other computer from when I was on Kuma, Aquila. If it was read access or read write access, I would have access to that particular folder. Now, another thing you can do, which makes it easier in the long term, is to map a drive letter to that shared folder. So again, from that other computer, Kuma, and I looked at Aquila, and I look at the share called shared files. I right-click on that shared folder, and then I choose to map a drive letter, or map network drive is the way they worded there. Next. And then it comes up and says, what drive letter do you want to give this? So in this case, I'm just choosing drive Z. Next. And also notice that by default it says reconnect at sign on. That's actually a handy thing as well, so that every time you start your computer, it'll automatically map that drive letter to that share on Aquila. Next. And then you can just access it as a drive letter. So rather than having to go to network, Aquila, and access share, I can just access it as drive Z. And I can treat it as if it was a local drive on my current computer.
And just a point there, Chris, too, you don't have to make it drive Z. If you use the drop-down menu, it shows you the drive letters which are currently unused.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yep. One thing I would caution is don't choose something really high in the alphabet, because if you happen to plug in a flash drive or something like that and it picks up that drive letter, you can get into things where, you know, all of a sudden drive letters start shifting around depending on what's available at the time and so forth. So typically with network drive letters like this or network shares, I typically try to work from the high end of the alphabet, and that way they won't get disturbed by, you know, other things that I plug into the computer. But you can choose any available drive letter. So you could use the mnemonics if you wanted. If it was like, you know, Chris's computer, well, I can't use C. C is not going to be available. But I know Linda on her computer, she has drive L, you know, things like that. So you can, you know, use other drive letters like that. So next. So some of my recommendations. So to start off, I figure best to configure a single folder on each of the computers, then, and give it read access to everybody else on the network. And by doing a read access, it'll prevent accidental modification of somebody else's computer. So if I have that mapped as drive Z, and I just access files on drive Z, and if I'm not used to network file sharing, I might say, oh, I don't need that file, I delete it. And if I had read-write access, I could happily delete a file that happens to be on another computer. So they would prevent accidents like that from happening. And then what I would say is make the files available to someone on another computer. You copy the files to that single shared folder that you want to make available to other people. And then the other people access the files in that shared folder. Next. As you become more and more comfortable with the whole idea of sharing across the network, I'd say open up that one shared file for read-write access so that people can drop files into that so that it's dropping it onto your computer. Or they could edit a file that happens to exist in that folder. I know as they get comfortable with the idea that they are actually working on somebody else's computer at that point in time. Next. If you become very comfortable with sharing concepts, try sharing out an entire drive for read access. And that way you can actually access any of the files on the other person's computer, but in read-only mode. Next. And if you get really, really comfortable, you could share out entire drives for read-write access, so you could treat anybody else's computer on the network basically as if it's on your own computer. You could copy files anywhere, delete files, whatever you need to do. So next. So what's good and bad about the whole concept of traditional Windows network file sharing? It will allow you to access files at any time as long as the other computer is on. You can easily read or write many files. So it's not like some of the other sharing that I set up or mentioned in the previous ones where you basically do a file at a time. Well, this you can just drag and drop a whole bunch of files and access them that way. Always having that drive letter pointing to a folder that is on another computer can be really handy. You know, you can always just think of it as, you know, my drive X is always pointing to Bob's computer and this particular folder or this particular drive or whatever it is. Just really, really handy to have that. Next. So on the bad side, it is a little bit more work to configure it, but it only is once that you really have to configure the network file sharing, and then the only configuration you have to do after that is setting up the actual shares. So if you start off with one folder and you decide, well, I just want to add one more folder, well, you just have to go in and share out that particular folder, and then other people are able to access it, or you decide to do an entire drive or whatever. So setting up the actual shares is an extra step, but once you get familiar with the concepts, it's really fast and easy. So the bad, computers do have to be on in order to access the files. So if you set up a share on a laptop computer and then that laptop computer disappears out of the house or gets shut down or whatever, the other computers on the network obviously are not going to be able to access those files. Unlike network attached storage, where you have a device that is always on, always there, able to act as a file repository, or cloud sharing, which is sort of like a remote network fast charge where it's always on. And so as long as you've got an internet connection, you can actually access that data. Next.
Okay, Chris, before you finish, a couple of questions from Tom, which I think you've answered, but it'd be good to clarify. He says, so you could have one folder read-only and another folder read-write.
Yep. Each share has its own permissions of either read-only or read-write. And so you, it's interesting, you can actually set up a share. You can set up two shares that actually point to the same location and have one read-only and the other read-write, which is, gets really confusing. But the idea of a share on the network, it is a pointer to a folder or drive, and each share has its own permissions.
Well, that one's mind-blowing, Chris.
Yeah, I know.
And then the second question.
If you want to go even beyond that, you actually have file-level permissions as well as share-level permissions, but we won't get into that.
So the second question was that the Z drive is local to the accessing computer, but it could be drive Y or another letter.
Yes, that's right. So when you're on the remote computer accessing a share on a different computer, that if you do map a drive letter, it is completely isolated to that computer. And it can be definitely a different drive letter on, or no drive letter if you want, on another computer. That's right.
Okay.
Okay, so just a final wrap up on this. So I covered off five methods. So on April 17th, we did nearby sharing and sharing files in the cloud. On May 1st, we did network cache storage and local send. And this week, we wrapped it up with traditional Windows network file sharing. Next. And a call to action. So there are a lot of other options for sharing files between multiple devices. And so anybody out there who has a different method that they use, maybe you'd like to let other people know what it is you use and why you chose it over one of these five that are listed on the slide. And if you can help out, let us know at with an email to suggestionbox@opcug.ca, and we will gladly slot in some time for you at a future Q&A.
And Jess just added a comment, says he's also noticed with Microsoft accounts that there is user-level sharing as well.
It's actually really the same thing, because what I did was, in my example, I said share it with everyone, and that really just means all accounts. You can actually do sharing where you can do it, select a particular user that you want to be able to give access to. The tricky thing on that is that where is the user account that you're giving permission? So if I share out a folder and I want to give permissions to a username or a Microsoft account, well, Microsoft account would be a good way of doing it, I guess. But if you do it with a local account, then how does a remote computer access that? Because they have to point to the user account that is on the other computer, and it can get really confusing. So Microsoft account, actually, that really does make sense, because if you do it through a Microsoft account, then as long as the other person is logged in using that Microsoft account, permissions should flow through properly. So that actually is a really good way of doing it if you wanted to limit it to certain people on your network as opposed to everyone on your network. But
okay,
my final word on that, though, would be that from a security point of view, you got to realize that these are computers that are on your local network. If anybody has physical access to a device, I say all security bets are off, because there are ways of accessing things that go beyond the permissions that are generally granted. So that's one of the reasons why I'm not overly concerned about sharing to everyone on the network, because they have access to the physical device anyways. Okay,
that's it. Chris. So I'm looking forward to what other people are doing, and we'll hopefully find out. Okay, next up we have an item from Bob Harris, And Bob is going to share his screen and talk to his own slides.
Thank you, Alan. And here. You should see a blue screen now, maybe?
Not yet.
Okay, I'll get here. Do you see something now?
Nope.
Oh, no. And,
Oh, there we go. Started sharing.
Okay, good.
Okay.
I'm bad at these things. Okay, thank you much. Very good. Microphone's on. So, good evening. I'm here to tell you about news readers. Okay, forget news readers. I know you all want news generators. It's about time that you started making your own news. So, here are two free websites that will help you generate your own news. The first one is very simple, Class Tools. You can Google it, Class Tools, Breaking News. And on here, on this one, there's lots of options. You simply choose a graphic you like that appeals to you, type in your custom news in the left-hand panel, and instantly, before you know it, you'll have your own custom news page. You might put in OPCUG's Pizza Night, June 12th. If you want, you can add in the bottom, register by email at pizzaparty@opcug.ca. Well, the graphic looks okay, but I really wanted to get an AI-generated video. Have you heard of vidnose.com? They can create AI videos in just 1 minute. It's simple, quick, and best of all, it's free. Let's get started. Here are the instructions. It says, pick a template, type your script, and click generate. Well, even I can do that. Now, Vidnose site has tons of options and free choices and options. Some of them you can pay for, but lots of free ones. I picked this one in the bottom left corner. Oh, yes. Breaking news template. This looks perfect. It's just what I need. So I signed in using my Google account and followed the instructions. Now get ready for some live breaking news. I'm thrilled to share with you my very first AI generated video. I've got to share this correctly. Close this, and we're going to find this box to share. I'm going to change that to screen two. No, I'm not good at this. Here we go. Share. You don't see anything at all. What are you guys seeing?
PowerPoint screen right now, Bob.
Good. That's good. Where it says breaking news, right? You see that?
Yep.
So I'm going to close that window, and here we go with the next one here. You should see the screen now, correct?
Yes, yep. Indeed. Yep.
Very good.
Good evening. I'm Sam at the Ottawa News Desk, here to share the latest buzz about an upcoming event that's got the entire city talking. The Ottawa PC Users Group is throwing a party to end all parties, and trust me, you won't want to miss this one. Save the date, because on Wednesday, June 12, 2024, at 6 p.m., the excitement kicks off at Britannia Park, right at the trolley station. Rain or shine, they've got you covered with a cozy spot, free parking, and easy access to bathrooms. But wait, there's lots more. We're heading live to our reporter Fred, who's already on the scene at Britannia Park to give us the inside scoop.
Thanks, Sam.
I'm Fred reporting live from the heart of the action here in Britannia Park. The energy here is palpable as people start pouring in to check out this beautiful venue. And rumor has it that on the night of June 12th, none other than Chris Taylor, the esteemed award-winning president himself, will take to the karaoke stage, belting out Shania Twain hits. Yes, folks. Get ready for a night of unforgettable entertainment. But that's not all. We're talking about a feast fit for kings, piping hot pizza, ice-cold drinks, and mouth-watering cupcakes that'll have you reaching for seconds. And guess what? All club members and their guests are invited to join in on the fun. As you can see, the excitement levels here are through the roof already. Back to you, Sam, for more on what to expect at this incredible event.
Thank you, Fred, for that exhilarating report. It sounds like this party is going to be one for the books. And speaking of Chris Taylor, rumor has it that his signature dance move involves a series of twirls and spins that are as entertaining as they are unforgettable. Folks, mark your calendars because Wednesday, June 12, 2024, is the date to remember. Britannia Park at the trolley station is where you'll want to be at 6 p.m. Rain or shine, they've got everything sorted out for a fantastic evening, and they even have door prizes for members. But wait, they need your help to make this bash truly legendary. Don't forget to shoot them an email at pizzaparty@opcog.ca with your RSVP, let them know your pizza preferences, and whether you need a ride or can offer one. Let's make this party one to remember.
Hello, it's Chris Taylor. I'd like to release a short statement to set the record straight. First off, a huge thank you to the City of Ottawa for generously providing the karaoke stage. And yes, you heard it right, I'll be on that stage Wednesday, June 12th. Some of you may not know this, but I've been moonlighting as a backup dancer for none other than Shania Twain herself at her concerts. So get ready for the ultimate Taylor Twain extravaganza. I'm counting on all of you to join me in enjoying some hot pizza, cold drinks, and delicious cupcakes while you cheer me on at this epic celebration. Dust off your cowboy hats and mark your calendars because this event is bound to go down in history.
Step aside, Chris, for a real star. I've been honing my vocal skills in the shower for several months now. My rendition of Bohemian Rhapsody is nothing short of spectacular. This year's pizza party just got a whole lot more entertaining. See us at the trolley station for a show you won't soon forget.
You can't be trusted, Bob.
Well, you heard it here first. This year's pizza party is shaping up to be a fantastic event. There'll be some big names on the stage. And to remove all doubts, you've just seen video clips here from the big stars. Yes, they took a break from their hectic schedules of being fabulous to confirm that they'll be here this year. This year's pizza party is one you won't want to miss. Register now by email at pizzaparty@opcug.ca. Thank you, everybody.
Even Alan left.
Thanks, Bob. I know you can't be trusted to put on something without putting one of us on the spot. I certainly can't promise my dance moves, but thanks for promoting the pizza party. And yes, everybody, make sure you register. We don't have as many numbers as we had last year yet. We still have time, but make sure you get your email in.
Very good.
Thanks, Bob.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Bob. Now I understand what they mean by fake news.
Okay, glass.
That was all done by Ved Knows. It's all free, too, anyway. You can do that pretty easily. Very good. Glass wire, sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah, very cool there, Bob. That's an interesting site. Okay, yeah, I came across this. I'm a longtime Glasswire user on the Windows PC, but they They have an Android app as well, and they just recently made it free for everybody. So GlassWire is certainly best known for the desktop program, and it works. It's not a firewall by itself, but it works with the Windows firewall to manage traffic. So you can block programs from accessing the Internet, discover devices on your Wi-Fi network, and a whole bunch more that you can actually do with it. It's actually a very interesting program. They have a free version that is more a reporting tool than a blocking tool. They have a paid version that allows you to do actual blocking. Next. So they have their GlassWire for Android, and it was just made available very recently for free to anybody. And some of the things it can do, it can detail the amount of data that is being sent or received for both the Wi-Fi network as well as your mobile network. You can chart which apps are actually using data and how much data they're actually using. You can allow or deny apps from being able to connect to the network. You can get alerts on your data limits so that you don't go over your monthly limit. It is polite and safe in that they say it doesn't send or receive data itself, so nothing leaves your phone that has anything to do with GlassWire, and there's no usage data ever that leaves your phone. So they're not sniffing for traffic. They're not trying to scoop up any data or anything like that. It's simply a local tool. And, you know, I'm quite impressed by it. Let me just paste in those URLs into the chat. Okay, next. So the easiest way to access it once you've got it installed, I find, is to go to the Android notification screen. Next. So you end up standard on Android, you pull down the notification screen from the top of the screen, and you will always have an entry for GlassWire on there, and it will tell you the amount of data on both the Wi-Fi network as well as the mobile network, so you can tell at a glance, you know, how much you're using each month. Next. And then you can just tap that notification to actually open the entire GlassWire app. So that, to me, is the easiest way to access it. Next. So then you get this somewhat busy screen, but at the top you have the period. You can select for either day, week, month, or you can set up a custom one, so you can set up a two-week period or something like that if you wanted. Next. And then you can say whether you want the charts and data that is appearing on this screen to be for either mobile, Wi-Fi, or both. Next. And then you have the data volume for that period. And so you have blue for downloading data, green for uploading. And in this case here, I'm on a month, so you'll see one bar for every day of the month. Next. Then you have the total data for that period, and you have it both in upload and download. Next. And then you have the total data for that period broken out by whether it's on the mobile network or the Wi-Fi network. Next. And then you have the data that's used by program. And again, you have it download and upload and the volume. Next. And then you have access to other functional areas within the program. So you can go, you're on the main screen right now, and you can go to firewall, data plans, alerts, and menu. So we'll explore those next. So, before we go on to explore those, you can actually tap on any data bar that you actually see there, and it will bring in the data for just that period. So in this case here, I was on 1 month, and I tapped on one of them, and it will bring up the data for just that day. If you're in a week or a month view, each of those bars is a one-day period. If you're in a day view, each bar will represent a three-hour period. Next. And then the bottom part will update to give you the data for just that period. Next. You can also get a live graph, so you actually have a moving graph of the last minute of traffic. I didn't find that to be terribly useful, but if you really want to drill down to what's going on your phone right at this moment, you can do so. Next. And then you'll see the apps that are actually using data in that last minute. Next. And if you want, and when the live graph is enabled, you can actually get these floating bubbles that go up showing live data by app and volume. So you can see here I've got four bubbles. So I have Gmail doing 11 kilobytes. I have, I guess it's the app, the Google Store did 11K and a 4K, and then I had a calendar item that actually used 7K. So you can see these bubbles float up in real time. Next. So the next tab over is the firewall tab, and it will be off by default. And so you can turn it on by just tapping on it. Next. And then you can actually have it where you can, if you want, you can block new apps from accessing the network until you actually say you're allowed to access the network. So the wording is a little bit poor on there. It is off like it is there now. If you tap that, it'll turn it on, and then new apps only will get blocked from accessing the network until you get an alert and you can say yes, allow it, or no, deny it at that point. Next. And then you can also manually block things as well. So if you see an app on there, you think, well, it's using a bunch of data, and I don't want it to actually access the network, you can actually tap the circle, and it'll actually block that app from being able to access the network. Next. And you can see here what it does is it's an alphabetic list, but any blocked apps are float to the top. So here I've blocked three apps, and so they show up at the top of the list so you can easily pick them up. And then you can, you can notice, oh, yeah, I blocked that app. I want to allow it now. You can toggle it back to allow its data to go. Next. Alerts I didn't find particularly useful. It's just when a first network activity is typically what you end up seeing, and it's just when an app is first trying to access the network, and it'll just show up in the list. You'll get an alert on that. I just ignore them. Next. This was an interesting one of the data limits. So you can help you to avoid overage charges. So you can go in, you can set up a plan, you can set up a data limit. You can set it by kilobyte, megabyte, gigabyte, or terabyte. Next. And then you can have it measure either mobile data, Wi-Fi data, or both. Typically, you would only want to have it measuring on mobile data because you're not necessarily charging on your Wi-Fi data. Next. And then you can set the duration for this particular data limit alert that will come. So you can set it to monthly, weekly, daily, or you can do a custom period. Next. And then you can set the start date for the cycle. So my billing cycle starts on the 6th of the month. So I set the start date for that, and it'll be a monthly report that starts on the 6th of the month, and it'll do its alerting based on that. Next. There are flexible notifications, so you can have it pop up, you can have it sound, you can have it just show a notification, you can have it appear on the lock screen and things like that. So a lot of things you can do on the notifications when you hit those overages. Next. So I ran into something that I first off thought it was a bug. So I found that if I enabled the firewall, and it didn't matter whether I had the allow or deny new apps on or off, and I used K9 mail, any communications, either sending or receiving mail, seemed to take forever. It did eventually come through, but it might be hours later before it would actually go through, which I thought was really, really bizarre. And I also noticed that there was nothing marked as being blocked in the firewall. So I bugged that with GlassWire, and next, turns out that reporting problems sometimes works. So you can see here they replied back to me at one point saying, please consider switching the firewall from experimental mode to the default one. And so I went next, and sure enough, I could tap on the top right icon, next, in the firewall, and then it would get to where I could have default or experimental. And I had actually changed it to experimental because the wording of that led me to believe that there is nothing wrong with turning on experimental. The wording for experimental just says that there's some future thing that they want to actually be able to do with GlassWire. It would give them data in order to be able to add that host monitoring, whatever it was actually going to be. But it did not. So I thought it was doing a favor to GlassWire to be able to give them data that would allow them to enhance the product in the future. Next. So I changed it to default, and then the problem was solved. So after that, K9 worked exactly as it did before, instantaneous transmission of data and so forth. So I do recommend that you leave it on default until such time as they, I suggested to them that they might want to update the wording to experimental to indicate that this may actually affect traffic. I haven't heard back from them. Oh, I did hear back from them. They said they would send that on to the developers. So that's it for Glasswire. I think it's really, really useful on Android. It is very low overhead, it seems, and it gives a wealth of data about what data is coming and going on your phone. And it's free.
Okay, great. Thanks very much, Chris. That's it's an interesting app. Tom had a comment which I think he's going to have to clarify for me. He says, denying apps is great, especially
yeah.
when they don't need it.
Yeah, especially when they don't need to be sending data, I think is the point. So if you have for example, you have a flashlight app on your phone, it should not be trying to access the internet. Now, some apps are ad-supported, and if they don't need to access it for any other reason, if you turn on a block on that, it may prevent new ads from coming into your phone. And Linux is not considered Android, no.
Well, for example, a calculator. A calculator does not need much internet access, usually.
Well, except if you have a currency conversion in your calculator or something like that. You know, it's surprising. It's like my K9 mail problem. I mean, I didn't think that this would be affected by block. You know, anything that Glasswire could do would affect it one way or another. So if you do use the program, and especially if you start blocking apps and things like that, make a note of the fact that you did actually block it, so some unexpected consequence comes about, you can reverse that action. But I find now, as long as you leave it in the default firewall mode, or don't turn on the firewall at all, I've never had any issues with the app at all. So, really nice app.
Okay, so we're into the last 10 minutes, actually the last 4 minutes, I think, if anybody has any other questions. I didn't see anything else in the chat. So open up your microphone and let us know your interests. Well, Natalie's saying if anybody's interested, trashnothing.com, which is one of these recycle type things, has a post for a Raspberry Pi 2G SD card, 512 megabytes of RAM. Raspberry Pi 2G SD card, I guess. Not yet taken. Anybody want a Raspberry Pi?
Get it soon.
Not taken yet, yeah. I might have a look at that myself. I don't think that will last. Okay, any further questions, comments, or shares?
I don't see anything coming
up in the chat for Bob's fake news item. Oh, Natalie's put the link in for Trash Nothing.
Thanks, Natalie.
Okay, so next up, next week, May the 22nd, will be our next Q&A session. So if you have questions or follow-ups to things that we've talked about tonight or previously, or topics that you'd like to share, maybe you'd like to generate some fake news, or maybe you have a different way of sharing to the ones that Chris has mentioned. Whatever it is, let us know, and we'll be happy to add you to next week's agenda. And so I really enjoyed tonight. I certainly enjoyed Bob's presentation.
Before we go, Elizabeth had a comment there that I can answer to. Minor share, I'm using Office 2007 and cannot save PDF as PDF as Word. So, Elizabeth, are you trying to share, are you trying to save a Word document as a PDF, or are you trying to open up a PDF file within Word?
I'm trying to, I opened up a PDF and I want to save it as a Word document.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I was thinking you had the reverse. Okay, I'm going to have an article in the next issue of the newsletter about a PDF editor that will allow you to save a PDF as Word document. So look at that upcoming article to be coming out in the June newsletter. It's a free app, and it's a mixed bag, I find, on anything that is trying to convert from PDF to Word. It can be really iffy. If you have a complex layout, you'll end up with garbage no matter what you use, I think, to do the conversion. But if you have simple formatting, take a look at the app that I write about in the upcoming issue.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, so that's everything I have. So we'll see you all next week.
Thanks, folks.
Thank you all. Good night. Thank you.
Thanks for the fame and fortune, Bob. Well, well, fame deserved. Anyway.
Well deserved.
Darlene, if you're still there, oh, I think she's gone. Yeah. Darlene asked about turned off web filtering on Android, being asked to update accessibility. I update anything on the Android phone that wants to be updated. It's too much work to try to figure out any particular update, whether I want it or not. So I just let everything update. And that's all I see in there that needs answering to, I believe. Yeah. Okay, folks. We'll see you next week.